It is my distinct pleasure this evening to introduce to you Professor Charles Ogletree.
Good evening and welcome to the Harvard Law School Forum. It gives me great pleasure to introduce tonight the mayor of the most important city in the world. Tonight you will hear from Mayor Marion Barry, but before you hear from him, I think I'd like to tell you a little bit about what he's going to talk about and a little bit about the importance of his remarks. Mayor Barry has chosen the topic of public service in the 1990s as his topic tonight. I think it's significant, particularly for Harvard Law students, because Harvard Law School was served as the centerpiece of law schools in this country in being committed to public service. Within the confines of the District of Columbia, there are a number of Harvard Law School graduates who have worked long and hard in the interest of public service. The first, and a graduate of this law school some 30 or more years ago, is with us tonight. He is the former counsel to the mayor, and he's also the acting corporation counsel, a Harvard Law School graduate, Howard Law School professor, and a longtime committed member of the struggle in the Washington, D.C. and other areas. I'd like to recognize Dr. Herbert Reed, who is here tonight. Public service goes beyond the identifiable names and faces. In the District of Columbia, the chief judge of the Court of Appeals, the first woman and the first black woman in that position, Judith Rogers, is a graduate of this law school. The chief judge of the Superior Court of the District of Columbia, Fred Ugast, was a graduate of this law school. The former chief judge of the D.C. Court of Appeals, Ted Newman, who is now an associate judge, was also a graduate of this law school. Associate judges Frank Schwelb and John Theron were also graduates of this law school. The deputy director of the D.C. Public Defender Service, Angela Davis, graduated from Harvard. The U.S. Attorney, the current U.S. Attorney from the District of Columbia, Jay Stevens, is also a graduate of this law school. Countless lawyers from Harvard have found their way from Boston to Washington to engage in public service. One person who has been involved in public service all of his life is Mayor Marion Barry, Jr. He was first elected to office in 1978. He received acclaim and notoriety long before that. Some of you may recall that Mayor Barry, who was a member of the city council at the time, was also a victim of a shooting incident during a takeover at the city council many, many years ago. Although he's been the mayor for three terms in the District of Columbia, that only begins to typify his commitment to public service. He served on city council. He was the founder of SNCC in the 1960s. He was a graduate both with an MS degree in chemistry from Fisk and a BS degree from Le Moyne College. He is a native of Mississippi. He grew up in Tennessee. He spent the greater part of his active public interest life in the District of Columbia, and he's now seeking an unprecedented fourth term as mayor of the District of Columbia. In a city where politics is the lifeblood, he has exemplified a commitment to the services and the needs of the people. He will speak to you tonight on the topic of finding new ways to meet the challenges of public service in the 1990s. I bring to you the mayor of the District of Columbia, Marion S. Barry, Jr.
Thank you very much, Professor Ogletree. Let me express my deep appreciation, great pleasure, been able to appear here tonight at the Harvard Law School Forum. I'm indeed pleased to visit Harvard Law School, which is for many the apex of legal education in this country. You have to forgive me for the scratchy voice. I have a slight cold I've been trying to recover from the last 3 or 4 days. I hope my voice does not go out while I'm here. Also, I'll take credit for the nice weather you have here at Harvard, since I've been held responsible for the snow in Washington. In February 1987, after the Super Bowl out in California, we had unprecedented snow, and I got back into a whole whirlwind of controversy about why wasn't I there shoveling snow. So since I'm going to be take the blame for that, I'll take credit for this nice spring-like weather here at Harvard. Except I like Washington better. I'm just here visiting tonight, so I like that too. Harvard Law School's role in the development of lawyers have had an impact upon our nation is unsurpassed. Harvard alumni has been currently Supreme Court justices, governors, presidential cabinet members, leading civil rights lawyers, and leaders in our nation's business community. Harvard lawyers, as Professor Overtree has indicated, has been the forefront of the development and education of lawyers in our nation. This law school has long and rich tradition of producing lawyers who are and have been involved in public service. Tonight, I'd like to urge all of you to continue that Harvard tradition of public service. Follow the examples of the people that Professor Overtree talked about, but also follow the example of Felix Frankfurter, Charles Hamilton Houston, Archibald Cox, Judge William Hasty, William Griswold, and others. These Harvard lawyers had a major impact on our nation through their dedication to public service. You've already met my corporation counsel, Professor Herbert O. Reed, who's a 1945 graduate of Harvard Law School. He likes to say that he was here before he integrated the Harvard Law School, one of five blacks in that class in 1945, but he spent over 40 years of his life given to the public, 40 years or so teaching at Harvard University, and also the last 10 years as my legal counsel, corporation counsel. Again, I want to recognize him, Herbert O. Reed, as one of those persons who committed to public service. Herb. I'm reminded of Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, who's a strong advocate of public service as Harvard lawyers. When he walked these hallowed halls as a professor of law, he constantly reminded his students of the lawyer's obligation to contribute to the public good. Justice Frankfurter's belief in the benefits of public service are evident in his own contribution to the development of our nation's legal history and his distinguished legal service career in public service. Because I've dedicated my entire adult life to public service, I can speak firsthand about that experience. I was born and raised in the segregated South in Mississippi, grew up in Memphis, where everything was segregated, including the National Park Zoo. In fact, we could only go to the zoo on Thursdays. And if a holiday fell on Thursday, we missed our turn at the zoo. Not to mention the lunch counters, the libraries, the swimming pools, the schools, the parks, the buses, housing, and even the churches. So I understand firsthand the oppression of growing up in an apartheid system with laws and policies that were opposed to my views about equality, where blacks were treated as second and third class citizens. I grew up in a tradition where black people were not allowed to enter into public office and run for mayor, or city council, or county commissioner. So I knew then that something had to be done about this terrible apartheid system in America. Even as a youngster, I knew challenge. I knew that we had to struggle until freedom and justice and equality came to all of us. I became an Eagle Scout, which maybe was insignificant for some people, but it taught me a lot about values, about helping others as we helped ourselves. It gave me determination to do what I could try to do to eliminate this system of injustice. So in 1960, I was a student at Fisk University Graduate School when the City and Movement came to Nashville. We were involved in that movement, sitting in the lunch counters, trying to break down the barriers of segregation in public libraries and swimming pools and parks and schools. We're arrested some two or three dozen times trying to do that. I could have gone on and got a master's degree in chemistry, which I did. Could have probably had a fairly comfortable life, which I could have. But most of my professors said I was endowed by God with a fairly good mind and could have gone on and do something else. But I decided to give my life to the public. When I was a student at the University of Tennessee, the only black person in the chemistry department, I did my chemistry work at night and demonstrated against segregated restaurants in the afternoons. Again, because of my zeal and zest for freedom and justice and equality. I felt then, as I do now, that we must join together to make America a better place. And therefore, organizations such as SNCC and SCLC and others became the vanguard for the civil rights movement. Our efforts eventually changed the moral fiber of this country. You probably can't imagine how difficult it was in the Southern South in 1960, when there were very few black people registered to vote in Mississippi, or in Tennessee, Alabama, or Georgia, or the Southland, where black people could not enter into public facilities. Dangerously dangerous down there. where the Klan ran rampant with shotguns and hoods and tried to intimidate us in not doing what needed to be done. But those of us who believe in public service, who believe in ourselves, and we can make America better, continue to work hard at it. And therefore, in 1964, we had the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It didn't happen by accident. It happened because people marched and died and shed blood and went to jail and sang songs and protested to make it happen. 1965, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, didn't just happen. It happened because people in Mississippi rose up against this. Let me just say, back in those days, in Mississippi, you had to take a section of the Mississippi Constitution and interpret it to the registrar's satisfaction. And often these registrars were not even high school graduates, so they didn't know what you were talking about. If you happened to pass that, they'd ask you some questions, and this is for real, too. How many bubbles are there in a bar of soap? You could never answer that kind of question. And so back in those days, only about 20 to 30,000 black people were registered in Mississippi. And today, because of the civil rights movement, because of the commitment to public service on the part of a lot of people, over 40% of the electorate in Mississippi is black. Mississippi has the largest number of public officials who are black anywhere in the nation. Again, demonstrating that the struggle for full equality for African Americans can work and will work. Those laws weren't enough. It was apparent to me that a lot more needed to be done. The focus of the movement became broader and spread from the South to the major urban areas in the North, Midwest, and Far West. We learned early on that there was injustice, inequality, and lack of freedom even in the North or Midwest or other part of our countries. That racism and sexism was still alive and well even after 1964, 1965. There was no longer was the unanimous view of the tactics to be employed in enjoying full equality. Younger, more militant leaders like myself believe the movement should be more confrontational. Take on the system head on. Knock it down, break down the doors. Struggle by any means necessary, as Malcolm X used to say. While some of the elders in the movement advocated working within the system for racial justice equality. Eventually, SNCC sent me to Washington to organize young people in our nation's capital. Under my leadership, the Washington, D.C. chapter of SNCC organized bus boycotts, started a youth employment center program, initiated other programs for benefit of Washington's local community. In 1968, I was in Washington when Dr. King was assassinated. I saw the burnings and bombings of our stores. I walked our streets, see the anger and alienation of our people on the streets. But even at that time, I was not convinced that people had to riot in order to achieve full equality. There had to be another way out. There had to be a better way out. It became evident to me, however, that the best way to change society for the better was to assume the reins of power. Since I've been extensively involved with young people, I ran for the school board in 1971. Wasn't supposed to win. Dashiki Nguyen, Afro Nguyen back in those days, and militant. But I ran for the school board and won. Came as president for 3 years, trying to change our education system from the inside. I think we were successful in doing that. 1974, I ran for and won an at-large seat on the District of Columbia Council. Re-elected to the council in 1976. In 1978, I ran for mayor and won the Democratic primary. Again, underdog, we're supposed to win, supposed to come in third. But because of our commitment to the people, because of our hard work, we were able to come in first in the primary and first in the general election. I tell you all of that to say that public service can be exciting, that you can do some good, you can make a difference. I was so happy, Professor Ogletree, to be sworn in 1979 by Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, to be standing there, born the son of sharecroppers, having come up the rough side of the mountain, having struggled valiantly and vigilantly for justice and freedom and equality, and have Thurgood Marshall swear me in with a great feeling of joy at that particular time. I knew I had to continue doing what I had to do, trying to guarantee a job for every young person who wanted one, trying to meet and talk to foreign governments about the dope traffic, trying to do all I could to foster a healthy climate for business in Washington. Sought to encourage economic development in our downtown area and our neighborhoods, trying to give hope to those who had lost hope. My life in public service has allowed me to produce concrete results in the struggle to make equality available for every American. It's not been easy, but when you see the results, you realize the struggle and sacrifices are worth it. I consider myself very fortunate have been born at a time when Americans from every walk of life were able to join together in the 1960s to make a profound change in attitude and policies in this nation. My experience as a leader in the civil rights movement were the crucible in which I forged my skills of persuasion, negotiations, and coalition building, enabled me to become a successful mayor. Also, I have no doubt that these skills will be valuable to whatever capacity I serve after being mayor. Even though we were able to make stunning progress in the last 30 years, much remains to be done to make our nation a land of equal opportunity for all. There are over 40 million Americans still in poverty, 8 years after President Reagan and 1 year after President Bush. 50% of all families who are headed by female household, their children live in poverty. It's estimated that about 10% of all the babies born in America now are born addicted to crack cocaine. The gap between the family income of white and black Americans is widening. 10 years ago, a black family made 59% that of a white family. Today, 54%. That is, for every dollar a white family makes, a black family earns 54 cents. We also find that women are still being discriminated against in America, as well as blacks and Hispanics. And some would say even disproportionately so. We also are faced with a crack cocaine epidemic that's destroying the fabric of America. Let me just say this crack cocaine problem is not one limited to Marion Barry or the people of Washington. This is America's problem. 90% of all the cocaine destined for America gets here. 300,000 pounds last year. Can you imagine a country as powerful as we are, as technologically advanced as we are, with radar machines and satellites that can predict the weather and all kinds of other high technology, that we can only stop 10% of all the cocaine destined for America? The cocaine is grown in Bolivia, Peru, this country knows that. It's converted in Colombia, this country knows that. And yet 300,000 pounds have come to this country. So we have poor people who are poor, homeless who are homeless, seniors who go to bed without any food. We have young people dropping out of high school. We have an unprecedented murder rate, not only in Washington, but all over America. Black people kill each other, 80% around drugs, around crack cocaine. And so there's a need for lawyers, a need for public servants to get into our nation's city, to try to do something about the hopelessness, about the anger, and about the neglect that happened there. This nation does not care about poor people. If it did, it would not cut housing from $34 billion to $9 billion. If it cared about poor people, it would not cut domestic spending by 72% at the expense of poor people. This nation is going to spend some $700 million on something called a B-2 bomber. It can't even hardly fly yet, and yet it's going to cost, $70 billion. Each bomber itself will cost some $700 million. For what purpose? Why can't we take that $70 billion and spend it in our cities on the poor, on the homeless, on drug addiction, on health care, on all the kind of things that make our cities vibrant, but yet we spend this kind of money on a B-2 bomber that won't hardly fly? The B-1 bomber shouldn't have been built in the first place. And in fact, it's so technologically advanced that it was flying not long ago, about a year ago. And it was brought down, I hate to say the bomber crashed, but it crashed because the bird flew into the mode of it. And we don't need to spend that kind of money. We need to spend money on people, not on war. And so we need bright, energetic, and committed young people like yourselves to work on behalf of those who cannot help themselves. The poor are not poor because they want to be poor. Most of them are poor because they are victims of circumstances, born in a web of circumstances. Their mothers and fathers were poor, therefore they are poor. Their grandmothers and grandfathers were poor, therefore they're poor. And so we have three or four generations of people being poor, trying to break out of the cycle of poverty, trying to get an environment that's positive. But they are faced with hopelessness, with drugs, crime, teenage pregnancies, plaguing our inner cities, preventing young people less fortunate than you or myself from realizing their full potential. The best and brightest of our young people must become involved in these problems if we are able to solve them. We cannot say that it's up to somebody else to do it. Let somebody else go out and do it, and I wait and do it some other time. You must make up your minds this year that you're going to work this year. Not just talk about working, but work at it. When you graduate from Harvard Law School, that you're going to commit yourself to X number of years in the public sector. That you're going to do that at great sacrifices. Now, I know it's difficult, because by the time some of you all finish Harvard Law School, your loans are such that you cannot afford to work for $25,000 or $30,000. But we must find ways to do that. We must find ways to get the society to say that teaching and lawyers and legal aid people and social workers and counselors and others are important to the society. And so Harvard has tried to do something about that. You have a program which helps you with your loans. It's called the Low Income Protection Plan, which means if you take a public service job and make under $21,000, you're excused from paying any portion of his or her loan during that period. I have the belief you can make money anytime. And money is important to me and to you. But money's not the only thing in life. There ought to be some human feeling about what you do. There ought to be some self-satisfaction about what you do. And I can speak from it from experience. 30 years of my life spent to the public, making little or no money, making great sacrifices. And you can do it too. We urge you, regardless of your circumstances, regardless of your loans and your backgrounds and the history of what you need to pay back, that you give at least 2 or 3 years of your time to public service. Come to Washington. We can use you there. Professor Reed is recruiting lawyers right now for Corporation Counsel at about $29,000, $30,000 a year. That's not too bad. Not enough, but you can make it over that way. We can't pay you the $60,000 and $65,000 law firms pay you. We can give you good satisfaction helping somebody. Why are you here at Harvard Law School? You know, we know it's vigorous, and Professor Ogletree has a very vigorous agenda and makes you study awfully hard when you take his course in trial and advocacy and et cetera. But give some time to the community while you're here. Go out and find some young person that you can tutor, that you can become a mentor to. Go out into the community and get to know what's going on, particularly out of the Black and Hispanic community, other low-income communities. Also, another thing which mitigates against public service is the press. We have a very vicious press. I call them alligators and piranhas and sharks and barracudas. And they're just waiting to eat you up. Make one mistake and one misstep, and that's it. All you read in the newspapers now are negative reporting about me, about cities, about everybody. Negative reporting. Every afternoon, all you see on the news is some Black Hispanic person with handcuffs across some police car locked up. If you're in public service, you're bound to make some mistakes while you're human. Some professional mistakes or some personal mistakes. And the media's gotten so bad now, it wants to join you in your bedroom, find out what kind of bathrobe you wear, what time you and your wife go to bed, or do y'all make love once a week or twice a week. And that's true, isn't that right? At least that's what I found to be the case. Then you had the rumors and innuendos, the new McCarthyism. Because you may associate with somebody who may be doing something that's not quite right to do, they accuse you of doing that too. And so the media is responsible, in my view, for negating a lot of what we're doing, for mitigating against it. But do it anyway. If anybody's been beat up by the media, it's been Marion Barry. I tell you, I have had my beatings and whippings. But I'm not going to let anybody break my spirit. I'm not going to let anybody break me down. In fact, if I get knocked down, I have a philosophy that you lay on your back. Because when you're on your back, you can look up. You look up, you can get up. You can get up, you can go up. You can go up, you can succeed. And so, notwithstanding the media's prying and peeping and looking and unsubstantiated rumors, go into public service anyway. It can happen. If enough of us go into it, maybe they may stop it one of these days. I don't know whether they will or not. I also encourage you who choose public service, consider working with local government. Our local government will be the vehicle with which we address social problems which present the challenges of the 90s. Homelessness, drug-related crime and violence, drug use among our youth, and the cycle of alienation and dislocation that affects our nation underclass. We must break this cycle of poverty. We can break it working together. And poverty doesn't just affect the poor, it affects all of you. We live in an urban city where crime and violence is the order of the day. You may be the victim of a stray bullet from a gun dealer's gun. Maybe the victim of a burglary by those who break into your house to try to steal money to buy crack cocaine. You may be the victim of a rape or some other activity, if you're a female, by some drug-crazed person who's high on PCP or high on crack cocaine whose mind's not quite with him. But more important, do it because it's right to do, because it's human to do. Whether you read the Bible, the Koran, the Old Testament, New Testament, the message is the same. Clothe those who are naked, feed those who are hungry, give shelter to those who need shelter, and counsel those in prison. That's what we have a responsibility to do as Americans, who seem to have all of our good senses, our health, and our strength. Help those who need help the most. And so we're at a point in history when the federal government is doing less to respond to our national problems. Local governments are doing more. And therefore, we must do more. Do not wait until you graduate to respond to my call for public service. You can respond to the challenge of the 90s right now by beginning to examine the problems that confront our local governments, by examining even Harvard Law School to make sure that it's operating right in terms of women on the faculty, which there are none. I shouldn't be criticizing Harvard Law School. Come up here, shouldn't I? I'm in y'all's house. But there are no women on the faculty. Is that right?
No black
women. And there are no Hispanics on the faculty. And so at least you ought to get your own house in order, too. And so once you do that, we can move towards getting our other people's houses in order. As I said earlier, you can come to Washington, summer interns, to work in the mayor's office, local government. We had a young lady, her name is Edith Lampson. She graduated from Harvard Law School last year. Some of you may have known her. She came to work in my office, anti-lawyer, anti-everything, I didn't want to be involved with the law, anti-the society in terms of the structure in which it was, because of Professor Reed's persuasiveness, persuaded her to go into law. And now she's clerking for Judge Ruth Ginsburg in the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Again, Edith is demonstrating that public service can work. The possibilities are endless, and I hope you can pursue that. Please remember the struggle to make our nation a better place has not ended. It just evolved. People aren't marching the streets any longer, still have many problems. But we can do it. Let me finish by reading our credo in the Barrett administration in Washington, D.C. It says, we are proud to be employees of the District of Columbia government. We view our employment as the public sector as a privilege and an opportunity, not a right or just a job. We see our service in the public as a high calling, a way of life. Every employee of the government of the District of Columbia is expected to follow in this tradition. With this privilege comes responsiveness and responsibility. To be responsible and responsive, we must be courteous and knowledgeable about our duties, well informed about the services we provide, respectful and considerate of our fellow employees. We strive to be excellent. We try to do it right the first time and always seek to improve on our performance and programs. We place the highest value on truthfulness and honesty. We give a full day's work for a full day's pay. We never try to become cynical or complacent about the way we act or what we do. Rather, we are committed to the Barrett philosophy of providing caring, compassionate, and competent service. We should never forget that it's the taxpayers who pay our salaries and who provide the other needed resources to enable us to do our jobs. We must always be aware of our contact with the public is broader than most cities because of our delivery of our services as a county, city, and a state. We pledge ourselves to try always to make a profound difference. We must be creative and innovative risk takers. We strive to leave the district government and the environment in which we found it, a better place in which we found it. Let me leave it. The public has a right to expect that we will make a profound difference in the quality of life. The public has a right to respect proper respect from our courteous, knowledgeable employees and affirmative and efficient and managed District of Columbia government. The public has a right to know what our policies and programs are, to be informed when they change. The public has a right to expect the D.C. employees to be advocates for them, to demonstrate high standards of integrity, both personally and professionally. The public has a right to involve in government. On the other hand, the public has a responsibility to show proper respect to District of Columbia government employees and give constructive advice. We, as the District of Columbia government employees, many of us residents of the district accept and practice the Barrett administration creed. We're quality employees who can make a profound difference and can improve the quality of life for those who choose to live, work, or visit, or do business in our city. That's what we believe in Washington. That's what I hope you believe in. Again, thank you. God bless.
Mayor Barry will take a few questions. There are microphones on both sides of the floor. If you'd like to come ask a question, why don't you come on down and feel free to ask a question.
Well, we're not on the set of this meeting, we're getting briefly, but I'm asking Sam Donald some kind of question. There's been a lot of controversy and criticism of you, as you alluded to. acknowledge your ability to govern and to run the city. So how do you answer your critics when they call for your resignation?
Well, critics is what you call them, critics. They don't expect me to, expect them to be positive, but I have the support of the majority of the people in Washington. I'm going to run for office again next September 1990 in the Democratic primary, and we're going to win by at least 55-60% of the vote. One thing that I know is that those critics and some of them in the media want to demoralize me, want to confuse me, want to get me all upset and me not do my job. But if you talk with the people of Washington, even those who don't particularly like me, they will say we do a good job with managing the city government in terms of quality of services. So I just don't let it bother me. Don't spend a lot of time answering it. Just go about my business. And again, I'm a victim of the new McCarthyism, guilt by association. I'm not going to let that bother me either. I know what I do and don't do, and how well I take care of my body, and how well I take care of my mind. And that's how I feel about it.
And then you talked about now 40% of the Mississippi electorate is black. Well, what do you think, it seems there's a problem today in the fact that many of these barriers have been removed, but still nobody's voting, particularly in minorities. And it's hard for people and groups to work and try to empower people when people don't seem to want to take whatever it is that they now have. How do you suppose you can go around getting anybody voting, particularly in minorities?
Well, I think you have to have candidates that inspire people to vote. That's the first thing. You can't have lackluster candidates that don't stand for anything, fall for anything. I think in those areas where you've had good candidates, in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia, other places, you've had high voter participation. Andy Young is going to run for governor of Georgia next year. I suspect that you're going to have an all-out number of blacks and Hispanics registering and voting. You have Doug Wiley in Virginia, running for governor of the state of Virginia, Commonwealth of Virginia. And we've already seen a large increase in the number of black voters in that state. So you have to get candidates who are going to excite people. Nationally, we've not had a candidate excited anybody. I supported Jesse Jackson in 1984. 88 excited me, but he didn't win the nomination. I know I'm in the wrong state to say this, but the caucus didn't excite me either. And apparently didn't excite the majority of American people. And he knows that, so I'm not telling Mike if he doesn't know. I support him, worked hard for him, but I wasn't excited. I need to be excited, and I'm pretty good at going out. I vote every time, but what about those who don't vote? On the other hand, we do have a serious problem with registration. New York State alone, there must be two or three, at least almost 400,000 or 500,000 blacks and Hispanics not registered to vote, even though Dave Dinkins is running for mayor and he's going to win that job. We need to do more. We got to have candidates, though, who excite people and who stand for something. And people can see a difference. They got to believe that this person can make a difference in their lives. That's why in Washington, I attract a big vote all the time. The largest vote you ever get has been when I've run for office, because people have a view that I'm going to do something about their lives. And they're right, I am. That's how you get people registered to vote. Something to vote for and some candidates who stand for something.
I'm curious, how would you portray
Well, for those of you who might not know that, we are colonial slaves in Washington. The Congress controls our budget, controls our laws. Every law passed by the City Council and signed by me has to be reviewed by the Congress for 30 days. We're not going to curse the darkness and bury our heads in the sand because of that. We have an excellent relationship with Senator Brock Adams, who's the chair of our subcommittee in the Senate, and Congressman Julian Dixon in the House Representative. And the President just vetoed our budget last Friday around a very simple self-determination issue, the right of states to spend their own money on abortions if women so choose. I'm a person who believes that women ought to have a right to choose what they do with their bodies. And we've been consistent in that area. President Bush has been opposed to that, so he vetoed our budget. But we managed to make it around that through a continuing resolution. The politics in Washington are not racial as such. They may have racial overtones. I don't think that they're racial. They just have a different standard for us in Washington. We're treated differently than most cities, both in terms of voting and in terms of attitudes. There are things that I do that get news, or other local officials in Maryland, Virginia, you wouldn't even read about it anywhere. It's not one of race, I don't think. It's one of just a different status for us. And there are those who would say race has something to do with it. If I want a black mayor, that I would not be catching all the hell I'm catching in the Washington Post. I don't get involved in that. I hear that. I think part of my difficulty with the Washington Post is the fact that I've made sure that 38% of minority, 38% of all the D.C. government contracts were minorities, $175 million last year. When you start dividing up the economic pie, and $175 million going in the pockets of those that weren't going in before I came in office, that's a hell of a threat to some people in Washington. So that's how I look at it. Did that answer your question? Right. Yes.
And I know you defended the Secretary of State by saying that you associate with people in a strata of society. But I was just wondering if you don't think that such associations can cause people to just accommodate the question of sincerity of your instruction to keep the drug situation in that type of situation.
Well, what happens, and I'm sure it may have happened to you, you've had associates and friends over the years. I mean, I've seen them in a year and a half or two. I've not seen Chuck Lewis since March of 1988. And when you're not with people, you don't know what they do or not do. You assume they do right things. You assume that they are outstanding people. He came from a very distinguished family in the Virgin Islands. His father was in the cabinet, was a parliamentarian, a street named after him, great family. Never been arrested in his life. I never been accused of any drug use or anything in his life. And how was I to know that he would have changed his lifestyle since I saw him last? And he was down and out and went to see him. But again, suppose I did know he had used drugs. I don't see how it affects me in the sense of what I do. And that's what I call McCarthyism. There was a time when if you associated with communists, you were called a communist. You didn't have to be one, just be around them. Other times you advocated gay and lesbian rights. You have to be a gay or lesbian person. They call you gay and lesbian too. So I think it's the same kind of thing. I'm opposed to drug use. I've always been opposed to it. Even when I was in the civil rights movement, people smoking marijuana, I would say, I don't want to smoke that stuff. The only addiction I've ever had has been cigarettes. And I broke that in 1979, started back again in 80, and broke again in 83. So I don't know how you live in society, and I know what people are doing, and then all of a sudden you show up and they say, well, you're guilty because they're guilty. I'm not. You're law students. You know, you're guilty, you're innocent in this country, at least I've been taught, until you're found guilty, indicted by a grand jury, and tried and convicted. And yet I've been tried and convicted and prosecuted and persecuted in the media, based on nothing except hearsay. And in fact, Chuck Lewis, on the oath, testified we did nothing in the hotel room. They beat him up down there in the federal system for about 5 months and indoctrinated and brainwashed him and I guess took his energy, and he then lied. So that's simple to figure out. Does that answer your question? Now, in terms of my ability to govern, young people in Washington understand this. I have been after elementary schools, junior high schools, and high schools in Washington. I can't hardly get away from that because the young people want to talk to me, want to see me. They know one thing I've done. I've shown that you can stand up and survive, that tenacity can get you over. A lot of these young people are in adverse situations, but they need somebody to say, you got to have strength to stand up to drug trafficking, stand up to criticism of the media. And that gives them hope, too, that they can stand up. So I've been very effective with young people in Washington. And that proves itself by the fact that I have a significant number of them working for me, and will be working for me in my campaign next year, too. Does that answer your question? Does everybody understand the new McCarthyism? It can happen to you too. I mean, you could show up at a party someplace. Well, you went to a party tomorrow night, and you don't know what people are doing in the bathroom. You assume they're not doing anything but using the bathroom for bathroom purposes. And yet you find they're storing cocaine in there. All of a sudden they say, well, so-and-so, you're a dope addict because you were at a party. Is that right? That's not right to me. It seems to me that something's wrong with that happening like that. Now, my advice to you, if you find out, you better get the hell out of there. But that happens all over. You don't know what people are doing in their private lives. It's wrong to use dope, I tell you that. And those who use it, I don't condone it, never will. Don't even understand why you, I can't even rationalize people selling drugs. I talked to somebody the other day. So well, these young people, they're poor, they're deprived, they're hopeless, and they need money. That's why they sell drugs. I don't care how deprived you are. I don't care how poor you are. There's no rationale for selling drugs. So that's how I feel about it.
Yes, to continue on the issue of drugs, Washington, D.C. has the highest murder rate in the country, has the highest rate of PCP use in the country. And I'm just curious as there, what sort of policies or programs are you going to implement or have implemented to try to combat these problems? And how do you see a solution and how do you wish to address these problems?